This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast.
Press. Maybe this would help. Can you tell me what the issue is you're struggling with?
It's hard to believe this is happening. I'm struggling with how upset my wife is right now. I'm concerned that they're tearing apart my wife's brand new house.
So am I.
I want to minimize the impact on my wife.
So do I.
So how do we do that?
Well, we start by telling the truth.
Okay.
Okay. So where is she?
Get a map.
Hello, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
How's it going?
I am doing fabulous.
Well, that's lovely.
How are you?
I'm so fabulous, too.
It sounds like it.
So fabulous. I hope everybody else is doing great. We have another exciting true crime story from Crimes and Consequences. This one is a Canadian story.
We've had quite a few of those lately.
I know. I was just thinking about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how we learned that KD stands for Kraft Dinner.
Yes.
Not mac and cheese.
Not mac and cheese. And everyone scolded us.
It's Kraft Dinner.
Kraft Dinner, that we don't call it that in the United States.
Who knew?
Who knew?
So this is a Canadian story that takes place about between 2009 and 2010. It's pretty well known in Canada. And once I tell you the story, you'll know why. It's a pretty big deal. With that, if you guys haven't done so, please take 1 second to hit the subscribe / follow button on that lovely app you're listening to. And are you ready?
I am always ready.
Well, let's do it. So this starts out on September 7th. It's 2009. There's this pretty petite young woman, and she's laying peacefully, sleeping in her bed, completely unaware that a man has crept into her house and was looking over her, watching her while she slept, just waiting for the right moment to strike.
Terrifying.
He stared at her body. She was clad in a pink camisole, and she had pajama bottoms on. And he literally salivated at the thought of what was to come. He knew that this night was for his taking, and he knew there was no one home to protect Jane. I'm calling her Jane. That's not her name. So he could take all his time to act out the fantasies he played over and over again in his head. And by the way, Jane has an 8-week-old baby.
Oh, man.
Jane was startled and confused when she got struck in the head by something hard. It hit the left side of her head. And instinctively, she just starts lashing out. But she was no match for this 6'2" tall military man who was now laying on top of her with his right hand covering her eyes. Realizing that both she and her 8-week-old baby, who slept in the next room, were at this man's mercy, she decided that trying to fight him and making him angry might only increase the violence. So she tried to start a conversation with him. Which, kudos to her.
Right.
Because I don't feel like I would have been that smart.
I would have been in a fucking panic.
I would have just probably pissed him off even more.
Mm-hmm.
She asked him, how'd you get into my house? And he didn't respond. She asked him what time it was, stating that the baby always wakes up around 4. I told her not to worry about it. Then she asked what was probably the most difficult question of her life. Was he going to kill her? He said, I'm not going to kill you if you cooperate. Jane was ordered to roll over onto her stomach and to keep her eyes closed. If he even thought she got a glimpse of his face, he wouldn't hesitate to kill her. He hit her again in the head, and then again, and then again, and he repeatedly warned her, do not open your eyes. Once he felt he made his point clear, then he began a dialogue with Jane. He asked her her name. She lied and said it was Allison. He asked her how long she'd lived in Cozy Cove, which is a small rural community. It's really made up of cottages on a road around a lake. And it's in a tiny town or a village called Tweed. And this is in Canada. The young woman had moved there only a month earlier to be closer to her daughter's father. Even though the two weren't together as a couple, they wanted to raise their daughter together. She could have never imagined that this tranquil, sleepy town that's just filled with retirees, basically, could harbor such a creature like the one staring at her in her bed. Most of her neighbors didn't even bother to lock their door, but Jane did. And this is why she couldn't figure out how the man got into her house. But then it occurred to her. It was simple. She'd never considered, in all the time she would lock her doors, that she should probably lock her windows.
Oh, shit.
I know, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know what? I've probably done that too.
I lock everything
yours
now.
Yours are probably nailed shut.
Right.
There's no reason for you to ever open a window or a blind in your house. She had no clue that she caught the eye of this man one day while he was boating past her cottage.
Ew.
Because it was a cottage on the lake.
Mm-hmm. That sounds lovely.
After caressing her hair and her body for a moment, he then removed some pillowcases and he grabbed a baby blanket nearby and he ordered Jane to put her arms together behind her back. He made a comment like, I need to be able to control you better. She was hesitant, but she complied. I mean, what choice did she have? First, Jane's arms were tied together with a baby blanket. And then he sliced a pillowcase into small pieces and he used them to bind her wrists. He placed a strip of the pillowcase around her eyes and he secured it in the back of her head with a ponytail holder. He then placed an additional pillowcase over her entire head and that caused her to hyperventilate.
I mean, well, yeah, you feel like you're suffocating.
Exactly. In a small act of kindness, he then removed the pillowcase. And he shuffled her into the living room. She could hear what sounded like him ruffling through a bag. And in a calm voice, he told her he wasn't going to hurt her. And he wasn't going to rape her. He just wanted to take some photos of her.
Oh, no.
He removed her shirt, her pants, and her underwear. And he forced her to pose in some extremely sexually explicit manners. The camera was so close up to her genitals that she could feel it on her thighs. And then he stopped. And then he just started going through her underwear drawer. Then he walked back to her. He commanded that she stand up. And then he brought her back into the bedroom and he stripped the sheets off the bed. He bundled up any evidence that he thought would connect him to the scene. And Jane was instructed to count to 300 before calling the police. And with that, he exited through the back patio door. This was the first step in the transformation from a panty thief who stole women's underwear to someone who actually interacted with someone. His next step was to be a rapist, and then he would eventually become a killer.
Oh, eesh.
The fantasies that had been brewing in 46-year-old Russell Williams, who, by the way, was a colonel in the Canadian Armed Forces, had been there for years. He managed to contain the violent aspects of them for years. He would just instead creep into houses. And I will tell you all the creepy, gross things he would do there later. But then this darkness kept seeping through his reality. And it penetrated the disguise that he had as this decorated, respectful officer. Although Jane never saw her assailant's face, she was able to provide some details to the Ontario Provincial Police. The OPP. She said he, quote, seemed like a dad.
Oh, man.
He was likely between the ages of 30 to 50. He had no facial hair. He didn't wear glasses. And he never bothered to cover his face, only hers. He wore what felt like a tight sweater. And she could see through the bottom of, like, the pillowcase that had been around her head that he was wearing hiking boots. She thought he might have a wedding ring on. But the most significant thing she remembered was that he stunk.
Oh, God.
He smelled like shit. Now, the houses in Cozy Cove were roughly 30 to 40 feet apart, so none of the neighbors heard anything. And it seemed as if this pervert had just vanished into the night. But he would only be gone for so long. 3 weeks later, September 30th, 47-year-old Lori Massico was cuddled up on the couch in the living room. She had a three-bedroom bungalow, and she was falling asleep to an episode of Law and Order.
It's like when we hear people falling asleep to our podcast, right?
Yeah, she fell asleep to Law and Order. She was startled awake at about 1 a.m. by this painful hit to the head. As she came to, she realized someone was pinning her down on the couch with her daughter's Barbie comforter. Now, her daughter wasn't there, but the Barbie comforter is now, like, pinning her down, and she could barely catch a breath. Then she felt three more hits to the head. She was completely taken aback. She cried out, "What's happening?" And this man replied, quote, "You're being cleaned out. You need to be quiet. Don't make a sound." Which she no longer really could if she tried, because he was squeezing her neck with one of his hands. She ended up losing control of her bladder. He switched from his hand to his forearm and leaned forward to apply, like, maximum pressure on her. Her face started feeling really warm and tears trickled from her eyes. Then he released his pressure, and in a calm manner, he told her to take slow breaths. He told her, quote, "This is going to take a while, so just relax."
Oh, okay.
What the fuck?
I know. Yeah, no problem. I'll just relax right now.
The voice sounded faintly familiar to Lori, but his tone sounded strained, almost like he was disguising his voice. Then she could hear this man cutting and tearing her daughter's Winnie the Pooh pillow, the pillowcase. He then slid some strips of cloth under the comforter and tied them from behind around her eyes, warning her, "You don't want to see me." The comforter was lifted from her, and her wrists were tied with strips of the Winnie Pooh pillowcase. Her wrists were tied behind her back. He found some cables and wires, and then he used them to secure her even better. She complained that her head was hurting really bad, so he offered to go get her some Tylenol. What the hell?
I know.
And he rubbed her temples.
What?
Apologizing for beating her about the head. The next thing she heard was the rattling sound of a zipper being unzipped. Then clicks of a camera. With a flick of his knife, Laura's shirt was cut in front in two. Then he cut her bra, and he sliced her shirt again in the back. She could hear him breathing heavy as he was commenting on her breasts.
Aww.
He took her pajama bottoms and her underwear off. He caressed her with his hands, and then he rubbed the cold steel blade from his knife on her. He made her pose, ordering her to spread her legs, and he took close-ups of her genitals. She was made to do really humiliating things, like she had to pose on her hands and knees, with her head down on the couch's armrest. It was just humiliating. She could feel his breath up against her most private areas on her body. And again, he kept taking photos. Because she was blindfolded, she had no idea that the assailant's penis was exposed and only inches from her, standing out in the foreground of his photos. So he wanted it.
Oh, in the photos. Okay. Yeah.
3 hours after the assault started, he left. But not before stealing some of her underwear. Lori was just stunned. Like, she didn't know what to do. So she went outside and she smoked a cigarette. And then she called the police. At first, she wondered if her ex-husband wasn't somehow responsible for it. Because they were in the midst of a custody battle. A heated divorce. They had twin daughters and they were actually staying with her dad during the time. And she's like, could he actually hate me this much to have someone do this to me? The police investigated the scene, and they discovered a back window had been raised open and the screen was cut. Lori was shocked to find out that pretty much the same thing had happened just down her street only a few weeks earlier. The police had failed to notify any of the residents of what happened to young Jane. It was almost as if they didn't take her account very seriously. But this time, the authorities were taking Lori's attack very seriously. They canvassed the neighborhood. They went door to door. One of the doors they knocked on was that of Russell Williams.
Really? Did he live in the neighborhood?
Yes, he lived in the neighborhood. He lived in Cozy Cove.
Oh, my God. You're kidding.
No.
Ugh.
He hadn't seen or heard anything unusual in the neighborhood.
Yeah, he didn't.
Well, a few days later, while Lori was reliving the attack in her mind, it occurred to her how she might recognize the intruder's voice. It sounded a lot like that of 65-year-old Larry Jones, who was a neighbor. They called him the mayor of Cozy Cove. Everyone in Tweed knew Larry. And remember, Cozy Cove is a part of Tweed. He was a lifelong fixture in the community, and he lived in the same house on the same street for 44 years. He was married for 40 years to his high school sweetheart. And for 32 years, he worked as a municipal administrator. Imagine Larry's surprise when the police knocked on his door and wanted to question him and suggested that he bring a lawyer downtown.
Oh, shit.
They also told him they had a search warrant. And in that search warrant, they were looking for two size 32 purple bras, two pairs of Victoria's Secret underwear, two pairs of Old Navy underwear, two baby blankets, a thong, dark beige bed sheets, a knife, and video equipment. Of course, none of those items were found at Larry's.
Thank God.
Larry submitted to a polygraph and he passed. And after much reconsideration, Lori realized that although she thought it could have been Larry's voice, she really wasn't sure.
And that's why, unfortunately, eyewitnesses, their testimony or what they remember, sometimes very flawed.
I'm thinking, poor Larry.
I know.
He's mayor of Cozy Cove. And
I know. Everybody loves him probably.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And what Aww. The hell? And they're looking for thongs and Victoria's Secret shit in his
I'm
house?
I'm glad it wasn't Larry. Poor Lori. I would feel so bad, too.
Right.
Right?
I
mean,
sorry,
I would feel bad.
Larry.
I know, accusing someone that it, oh, maybe it wasn't him. I mean, poor woman was
probably
terrified.
But, you know, she's got to tell the police what
yeah,
she's
of course.
Thinking. So, meanwhile, Cozy Cove has this sexual predator on the loose whose fantasies are growing darker and darker every day. Russell had perfected what would be known as his rape kit. It was a duffel bag which included rope, plastic zip ties, duct tape, a flashlight, a knife, a camera, camcorder, tripod, and some sex toys.
Eesh. Did he make videos of Lori or Jane, or did he just take pictures?
He did both.
Did he?
On his next outing, Russell decided to bring a black skull cap and a dark blue headband to disguise himself. He wore a black hoodie, jeans, running shoes, and he set out for an attack. He'd been fantasizing about 30-year-old Corporal Marie France Como for a while. He was her commander at the Trenton Air Force Base. He'd even flown on a plane with her before, and he used his power to be able to find out personal information about her. Unbeknownst to her, a week earlier, while she was out of town, he broke into her red brick bungalow through an unlocked basement window. He rifled through her bra and panty drawer, tried on some of her undergarments, and took photos of himself in her house wearing her underwear. For 2 years, he'd actually been stealing women's lingerie, bringing them home, trying them on, photographing himself. But that thrill wore off, so that's why he had to up it.
Right.
It was about 11 p.m. when he left his house in his SUV. Now, there was an empty lot not far from Marie France's home. And she doesn't live in Cozy Cove, okay? She lives closer to the Trenton Air Force Base. He parked his SUV. He used the cover of darkness and the tall trees to camouflage him. He could see Marie France through her window. She was sitting on her bed talking with her boyfriend Paul on the phone. He went back to that basement window that he'd been in before. He removed the screen and he slid the glass open. It was cold inside the unfinished basement because it basically was an unfinished basement. There was a bed in it. Maybe she, like, I don't know why she had a bed in it, but for company or something. And he's in the basement and he's cowering near the furnace and he's starting to open his duffel bag. He puts his skull cap on and he positions that cloth blue headband below his eyes. So he's concealing a large portion of his face. To give you a little background on Marie France, she joined the military 12 years earlier. 2 years earlier, she became a flight attendant at 8th Wing in Trenton. She was chosen to be a VIP flight attendant and flew the Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, on a trip to Japan.
Wow.
She'd only been home from that trip for 3 days. She's on the phone. She's talking to her boyfriend, Paul. Russell's in the basement. He's just waiting for the right moment to strike. And he hears a cat meowing. Marie Francis's cat, Bixby, had came down into the basement. Then the basement light flicked on, and Marie Francis, walking down the steps, she's calling out for Bixby. She's naked except for this thin robe draped over her. Bixby had become fixated on Russell, who's hiding by the furnace.
Oh, shit.
And was meowing continuously at his feet.
Oh, man.
Marie France bent down to grab Bixby, and as she did, she caught a glimpse of this prowler, and she screamed out, "You bastard!" and he just started hitting her with a flashlight upside her head. Blood began dripping down her face as she fought. Russell lunged at her, and they both fell onto the concrete floor. Eventually, he overpowered Marie France, and he was able to bind her wrist with rope behind her back. Then he pushed her against this support beam, you know, basement support beam. And it had a quarter-inch steel pin sticking out of it. And the pin pierced her back.
Ouch.
Marie France was then tied against the beam, both at the chest and the thighs, to secure her legs. And duct tape was placed over her mouth. Then he grabbed the camera from the duffel bag. And he began taking photos of her naked. He left her there for a few minutes while he went upstairs and he got some knives out of her drawer. He went into her bedroom and he grabbed a comforter. And he used the knives to secure it around the window. So he like stabbed the comforter over the window, even though it had closed blinds there. He didn't want to take any chances.
In the basement?
No, he's up in her bedroom.
Oh, okay. In her bedroom he did that. Oh, because he's probably going to bring her up there, right?
Right.
Oh.
He removed the duct tape from her mouth. And he warned her not to scream. As he led her up the basement stairs, her bloody hands, she smeared them all over the wall, trying to probably balance herself. Because remember, she's been hit upside the head. At some point, she couldn't contain herself, and she just let out this blood-curdling scream. And so he took her head, and he bashed it really hard against the drywall, and it ended up leaving a large hole. She fell onto the carpeted landing. As she lay there bloody and exposed, he took more photos of her, including close-ups of her bruises, her breasts, and her vagina. At this point, she's unconscious, so he placed her on the bed. Her head wouldn't stop bleeding, so he went and got a towel, and he wrapped it around her head. He ended up wrapping her entire face with this towel and only allowing a small opening for her to breathe out of her nose. To keep the towel in place, he circled it multiple times with duct tape. Then he cut strips of duct tape and he placed them vertically down her face too, which is weird.
Yeah, that's odd.
I have no idea why. With the towel secured around her head and face and her wrist tightly bound behind her back, he got out his camera, a camcorder, and a tripod. For him, this is when the fun was going to begin. He took his pants off and he began to rape her. She's starting to come to and she's mumbling, no, no. He held one hand on the headboard and the other hand of his was holding the camcorder and he videotaped up close the rape. Then he placed the camcorder on the tripod. He grabbed Marie Frances by the left leg and began raping her from the side. By this point, she's fully conscious, though dazed, and she starts to struggle, but it must have seemed hopeless to her. When he was done with the first rape, he sat behind her on the bed and he began stroking her. Then he began examining her genitals up close, using his fingers and hands to expose her private parts. All the while, the tripod and the video camera are set up going. He forced her on her knees, bent over, and then he raped her again. She's screaming through this towel, demanding that he leave her alone. But the humiliation continued. She was forced to pose again in extremely explicit sexual positions, all the while being filmed. And there's footage, you know, there was footage of this as evidence. And in it, he's got an erection and a smile. So you can see how much he's enjoying her suffering. After 17 minutes of filming, he removed his skull cap and the headband that covered his face. He then bit her breasts and he grabbed some KY jelly from his duffel bag and he raped her again. When he was done, he went into the bathroom. Then he walked in the living room and he peeked out the blinds. In Marie France's bathroom, it had a small window. And she decided while he was in the living room peeking through the blinds, she was going to try to make a run for it. She made it to the bathroom. She shut the door and she tried to lock it, but her hands were tied.
Oh, shit.
And by the time it was too late, he was too quick. He pushed open the door and he pummeled her into the bathroom wall. He ended up breaking a glass framed picture with her head. She was dragged by the hair into the bedroom and forced onto the bed. But she couldn't keep her balance and she kept falling off. He pulled her back onto the bed, and then he just raped her one more time, the camera. By then, Marie France was defeated. She was too weak to fight back. As she lay in the bed, her lingerie, her bra, and her underwear were placed on her, almost like a display at a store, and then more photos were taken. He ended up taking those items that he used for this display photo and putting them in his duffel bag. So they would be trophies. Once again, he violated her, most likely anally raped her. By this time, the towel had relaxed a little around her head, and she was allowed to mumble, like she could mumble some words. She pleaded with him, "Don't kill me." And he hushed her. She cried out, quote, "I don't want to die. I don't want to die." After glancing into the camera, he placed his left hand over her nose and mouth. And then within seconds, she went limp. He removed his hand and thought for a second. Then he grabbed a pillow and he placed it over her face. With all his weight, he leaned on it. Marie France began kicking and screaming. She managed to free herself from underneath the pillow and screamed out, "No, I don't want to die." Russell jumped up. He was like, "Whoa, whoa." And after he gained his composure, he grabbed the pillow and he tried to smother her. He tried to lay across from her to stop her from moving, but all her wiggling paid off and she was able to push him off the edge of the bed. Finally, after all her fighting, he acquiesced and he told her if she quit screaming, he would stop. He ordered her to stand and he offered her a glass of water.
Unbelievable.
She said, "You're going to kill me, aren't you?" And he started putting on his clothes. He told her no, he was going to be leaving soon. He started gathering up his stuff, and Marie France just tried to have a conversation with him. She was pleading with him, just go, let her live. I'm not going to tell a soul. She must have noticed that the red light on the camcorder was still on, indicating that he's still recording things. She cried out, "Please give me a chance, please. I want to live so badly." In quick succession, he ripped off a piece of duct tape, and he placed it over her nose. He put another piece on her mouth. Then he took a step back and he just observed her. She's mumbling something along the lines of, "I don't deserve this. I've been good my whole life." And again, there's a video of it. It's kind of confusing how she can be talking when they're saying there's duct tape. But according to the transcript, it says, "I don't deserve this. I've been good all my life." Then she slid down the wall onto the floor, whimpering, "Have a heart, please. I've been really good. I want to live." And he just stared at her. And eventually, it took a while, but she quit breathing and died. Mm. So it must have been cutting it off, but not completely her air supply. I don't know. Her killer paused the tape, and then he took some more photos of her.
Oh, fuck this guy.
When the recording resumed, Marie France was laying dead. She was now naked on the bed with her legs crossed at the ankles. Towel and duct tape that had covered her head were gone. Prior to leaving, Russell took all the bedding and the towels, and he threw them into the washer along with a gallon of bleach. It was 4 a.m. It was too late for him to go home. He had to go to a work meeting.
Oh, shit.
So he just drove directly there.
Wow. Was he married?
Oh, I'll get to that.
Okay.
This was his first killing, but it wouldn't be his last. Before I tell you more, though, we're going to take a quick break. 2 days later, Marie France's boyfriend, Paul, he became worried after not hearing from her, and he drove to her house, right, to check on her. That's when he found her body wrapped in a blanket on her bed.
How awful.
Police didn't connect this to the assault in Tweed because she lived in Brighton, which is near Lake Ontario. It's about an hour away from Russell's home. So they had absolutely no clue who tortured and murdered this woman. News of her murder quickly, of course, ran through the Canadian Air Force Base in Trenton. A few days later, her parents received a letter of condolence from the commander of the Air Force Base, Colonel Russell Williams, who's expressing his sympathies. I'll just read part of the letter. It says, "Marie France was a professional, caring, compassionate woman who has earned the respect of all she came in contact with. She has and will have a lasting impact in Trenton and will be sorely missed by her many friends. Please let me know whether there's anything I can do to help you during this very difficult time. You and your family are in our thoughts and prayers."
Oh, my God. The fucking balls.
Touching gesture from the very man that raped and murdered their daughter. What's strange is that Russell had no history of violence. He'd been married to a woman named Mary Elizabeth for 19 years.
Wow.
And he was a doting husband. He didn't have any children, but they had cats. Russell was a huge fan of cats. And in 2007, one of his beloved cats died, which was pretty traumatizing for him. Mary Elizabeth and Russell had built this nice house in the Ottawa suburb of Westboro, and Mary Elizabeth lived there full time while Russell lived in the Tweed home when he wasn't working. I mean, the goal for him was to eventually move into that home, but in the meantime, he lived in that Cozy Cove Tweed house alone.
So that's why he was able to do all the shit. She wasn't there.
Exactly. It was a Thursday evening in January of 2010, around 9:30 p.m., when 21-year-old Jessica Lloyd drove her Pontiac Grand Prix home. After a long day of work and a visit with some of her friends, she met this friend, Dorian. Jessica lived in Cozy Cove. She had a country bungalow. She was all alone. She bought the house from her mom like 8 months earlier. When she made it home that night, she sent a text to her friend, Dorian. It was at 10:36 saying, night, night. Jessica didn't know that she'd caught the attention of Russell one night, almost 2 years earlier, when he was creeping around homes. He became aroused when he saw her running on her treadmill and never forgot about her. That night, Russell parked his car down the road from her home. He left it in a field. He grabbed his duffel bag and he trotted across to her house. Now, her house sat in a lot that's far back. Like, it's deep into a lot.
So it's like a large front yard kind of thing.
Exactly. And it was lined with trees around it. Once she shut her bedroom light off, he put on his mask and his gloves, and he went inside through an unlocked patio door. I'm always locking my patio door.
Oh my God, everyone, check your locks, windows, everything, man.
He found Jessica laying in her bed. She was wearing sweatpants and a tank top and wrapped in a duvet. She was already asleep. Grabbing his flashlight with the intent on hitting Jessica over the head, he approached her. Then she suddenly opened her eyes. He's like, what the fuck? He overpowered her and he wrapped duct tape around her eyes. And then he managed to put rope around her wrist. And then he bound her wrists to the headboard. He gathered up all the lamps he could find
lamps?
In the house. Yes, lamps. So he could have good lighting.
Oh my God.
And he placed them around the bed. He wanted the best lighting possible to take these videos and photos that he was about to do. Using a knife he brought with him, he sliced off her clothes. And he gave her different instructions of poses. Spread your legs, bend your knees, open your mouth. He molested her and he continued to make her do all these demeaning poses and positions. Then he raped her, positioning the camera for up close shots. When he was done, he forced her on her knees and he placed two black zip ties around her neck. He was holding one end of the zip tie and he forced her to perform oral sex on him for the camera, warning her he could tighten it at any moment. He videotaped the entire assault until the camera ran out or something happened. It was 2 hours and 3 minutes of it. After he was done, he ordered Jessica to get dressed. And together, they drove to his own home.
Oh my God, really?
He forced her to take a shower with his zip ties still around her neck. And her wrists were bound with a screen rope. And duct tape was still around her eyes. Like something really straight out of a nightmare. He lathered up a bar of soap and began washing her.
Ew.
God.
I fucking hate this guy.
When he was done, Jessica was forced in the bedroom where he tied her wrist to his and then cuddled with her the rest of the night.
Girl, are you fucking kidding me?
No.
Oh, God.
What the fuck is that?
I know. What the fuck is that is right.
The next morning, the abuse continued. However, Russell told Jessica that after another round of sex and photos, he was going to take her back home. Jessica was allowed to get dressed, and he even offered her a bowl of fruit.
How kind.
In the final series of photos taken of Jessica, she's sitting on the edge of his bed. She's dressed, except for her shoes. There's a piece of duct tape covering her mouth. She's still blindfolded. By this time, she'd been with Russell for almost 24 hours. And he said, you know what? It's time to take you home. He made her walk with him to his garage, and she was in front of him, like he's pushing her in the right direction. As they enter the garage, he grabs a large flashlight, and he smashes her skull, causing it to collapse. He says he didn't mean to hit her that hard.
Then why are you hitting her at all?
Exactly. As she lay on the garage floor, he bent down beside her, and he noticed she was still breathing. So he placed this green rope around her neck and he pulled on it until her body stopped moving and he knew she was dead. Then you know what he did?
Oh, fuck. You're going to tell me.
He ran back inside and got the camera.
Oh, Jesus. I should have known. This fucking weirdo.
He took shots with a flashlight strategically placed by her head. He grabbed a roll of duct tape and he wrapped her body in the fetal position. By then, he didn't have time to dispose of her that day because he had to go to his office, he had to do some work, and he had to leave at 5:30 in the morning to go to California for a meeting.
He was going to fly to California for a meeting?
Mm-hmm. Of course, by this time, Jessica's friends and family realize she's missing. They go to her house. Her car is home. All her possessions are home. She's nowhere to be found. However, they do see two sets of footprints in her backyard. One's larger than the other, obviously Russell and hers. And those footprints lead to the end of the property. And where they stop, they found tire tracks. Police are called, and they make casts of the footprints, and they make casts of the tire tracks. For 2 days, police and the OPP emergency response teams, they're searching for her. An OPP search and rescue helicopter was provided by Colonel Russell Williams to help find her.
Oh, fuck this guy. Damn.
The police started to suspect that the Cozy Cove crimes and Marie France's murder were all connected to Jessica's disappearance. Tips began pouring in. There was a couple guys that saw some silver car in a field by her house. They thought it was some sort of like SUV type car. And then once they did the cast of the tire tracks, they knew that the only cars with this bright suspension, and I don't know shit about cars, that could have these kind of tires were going to be a Toyota 4Runner, a Jeep Cherokee, or a Nissan Pathfinder. So they start up a roadside canvas, and police are looking for any car that matches those specifications. And if there was a car that went down, there was a particular road. Because again, this is a small town, so it's not like 6 lanes of highway mm-hmm. of traffic you got to stop. So they're stopping any cars that match what they're looking for. Literally, one of the first or second vehicles they stop is a silver 2001 Nissan Pathfinder owned by Colonel Russell Williams, base commander for the CFB in Trenton. By the way, that's Canada's largest military base. And he's the commander. Do you know that he flew Queen Elizabeth?
He did?
He flew Queen Elizabeth.
Shut up.
There's photos of him and Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, fuck.
When they stopped his car, they noticed all of his tires were Toyo Open Country HT.
Oh, okay.
The tires they were looking for. Now their minds were really boggled because the guy driving this car is not anybody they would suspect
right.
to be responsible.
Like he's not a creeper.
But they realize, wait, he lives in Cozy Cove and he was Marie France's commanding officer, which is very coincidental. Plus, his drive to work every day took him right past Jessica's home.
Oh, boy.
So weeks gone by, they still haven't found Jessica's body. On February 7th, 2010, a detective called Russell and said, hey, would you mind just coming down to the station and providing a statement about Jessica Lloyd? He says, oh, yeah, of course. It's about 3 p.m. He comes down. He's talking. He denies everything. He says, oh, on the day she went missing, he had the stomach flu and was in bed. He offered to provide his fingerprints and blood samples. Then they asked if he wouldn't mind providing his shoes so they could make a cast. And he looks down. And he's wearing the same shoes. And he's like, yeah. They start putting the pressure on him. They tell him there's going to be a search warrant executed at his house. His vehicle is going to be seized. They're also going to do a search warrant in the Ottawa house where his wife is. So he's going to have to let his wife know what's going on. After 5 hours of bullshit, he finally confessed to all the crimes.
Damn.
He did it. He said because he didn't want to make his wife suffer any more than what she was already going to suffer.
Really?
He also led the police to Jessica's body. She was in tweed. She was wrapped in towels, laying 40 feet from the road by a big rock. Here's some excerpts from his confession. And you'll notice that when he's talking, it's just kind of not emotional.
Flat.
No affect.
Like, is this something where I can make a call and tell somebody to go to a location and they're going to find her? Or is this something where we have to go and and take a walk. Which direction are we heading in here? Russ, maybe this would help. Can you tell me what the issue is you're struggling with?
It's hard to believe this is not.
Why is that? Why is it hard to believe?
It's just hard to believe.
Russ, is there anything you want from me?
No, I'm struggling with how upset my wife is right now.
Russ, what are you looking for?
I'm concerned that they're tearing apart my wife's brand new house.
So am I. So what am I doing, Russ?
I want to minimize the impact on my wife.
So do I.
So how do we do that?
Well, we start by telling the truth.
Okay.
Okay. So where is she?
Get him out.
Let me see what I got here. I might have something. Is she inside, outside? Is it something where is she buried, or is she somewhere where if you walk there you would fairly easily see her?
It's here.
How long has she been there for?
A little over a week.
Was it fairly quick from the time she left?
Friday night.
Friday night?
Yep.
So where was she between Thursday night and Friday night?
In Tweed.
With you?
Yep.
How long was she alive for?
Almost 24 hours, not quite.
Russ, you're doing the right thing here. Okay.
Well, again, my interest is in making my wife's life a little easier.
In the end, Russell confessed to 82 break-ins from 2007 until 2010.
82 break-ins?
They were mostly like his neighbors.
Oh, my God. And he's stealing panties?
Yes. And one of his neighbors, he broke into their house 9 times.
What?
And he took photos of him in their lingerie.
Gross.
Thousands of photos were found on memory cards. He was wearing female undergarments he had stolen. And you can see on our website, crimesofkansas.com, what he looks like in women's undergarments. It reminds me a lot of BTK.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Many of the photos showed him naked in his neighbor's bed masturbating, including one of his neighbors who had a 12-year-old daughter. He was in her bedroom. There's a photo of him surrounded by little girls' underwear and stuffed animals.
Oh, my God. What a sicko.
He admitted to breaking into a home in the Ottawa neighborhood and spraying a 15-year-old girl's dresser with his semen.
Oh, girl.
He took a photo of himself with her makeup brush on his penis. He would watch through the bedroom of teen girls, and then he would strip naked outside their window and masturbate. In the end, they found over 600 bras and panties that he'd stolen from women and teen girls.
Holy shit, 600?
Yeah, and there were photos of him, and he would have them nicely lined up, like you're at Victoria's Secret looking at a panty, rows of panties, nicely lined up.
All just neat and, well, that's the military man
yes,
in him, right?
Right?
Right? Orderly and...
Yeah, and then I don't know what he ended up doing with all of them, but he had so many memory discs and all that.
Girl, think if he was your husband.
Oh, God.
Can you imagine this poor woman?
I know. Well, speaking of her, while he was in custody, he wrote a letter to her. It says, "Dearest Mary Elizabeth, I love you, sweetie. I'm so very sorry for having hurt you like this. I know you'll take good care of sweet Rosie. I love you, Russ." That's her cat, Rosie.
Rosie. Be like, fuck off. Can you imagine that poor woman, all the humiliation she went through?
He also wrote a letter to Jessica Lloyd's mom.
Oh, fuck you.
He wrote, "Mrs. Lloyd, you won't believe me, but no, I am sorry for taking your daughter from you. Jessica was a beautiful, gentle young woman, as you know. She loved you very much. She told me so again and again. I can tell you she did not suspect that the end was coming."
Can you imagine getting that letter too? I'd be so pissed.
"She was actually happy because she believed she was going to go home. I know you already have a lot of pain in your life. I'm sorry to have caused more." He did a rough draft of a letter first to her, and in it he said, quote, "The moment she died, she was quite happy because she believed I was letting her go. She didn't know what was coming."
Just gross.
He wrote a letter to Lori. Remember Lori?
Yeah, I remember Lori.
He said, I'm sorry for having hurt you the way I did. I really hope that the discussion we had has helped you turn your life around a bit. You seem like a bright woman who could do much better for yourself. I do hope that you find a way to succeed. Like, he had some great conversation yeah. while he was raping her, and hopefully it helped her turn her life around. He wrote a letter to Marie France's parents saying, quote, "I'm sorry for having taken your daughter Marie France from you. I know you won't be able to believe me, but it's true. Marie France has been deeply missed by all that know her."
These letters are disgusting.
Ridiculous.
I would be so fucking angry to get a letter from this guy. I'm so sorry. No, you're not.
He's not even slightly sorry.
No,
like, it's some comfort. She was so happy when yeah,
she was so happy
before I killed her.
Yeah, before I killed her, she didn't see it coming. She thought she was going to go home.
What world do you live in?
Just take comfort in that.
Well, needless to say, he was convicted for his crimes, and he's doing 25 to life in Canada. And he got stripped of all of his honors.
Oh, well, good. You mean he's not going to be collecting a pension soon?
I don't know. It's Canada. I don't know that, but I know, like, he got stripped of every
fuck
medal
this guy,
and honor,
dude.
And title.
What a creep. God.
So I want to give credit where credit's due. I got my information from a book called Camouflage Killer by David Gibb. And there's this YouTube channel, The Fifth Element, that I got my info from, too. I mean, I got it from some other places, but that's
the biggies.
Those are the biggies.
Well, thank you, Talia.
You're welcome.
I hadn't heard this story.
You hadn't?
No.
Yeah, I know. It was crazy. Like, he literally flew the queen around.
Right. Flew her around. I mean, he commanded a whole goddamn Air Force, the biggest Air Force base,
right.
mind you, in the country.
Crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody, for taking the time to listen. If you haven't done so already, hit that subscribe or follow button. You can also find us on social media at Hardcore True Crime and our website, crimesandconsequences.com, where you can see some pictures of Russell Williams, nasty ass Russell Williams. And what else? Oh, we have a Patreon.
Yeah.
Where you can get exclusive ad-free early releases and
bonus episodes.
Bonus episodes, lots of bonus episodes. And you can also do the same by going to our Apple channel and hitting subscribe there.
It's patreon.com/TNTCrimes. I think you got everything.
Sounds good.
All right. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.